Case number 201527, Freddie Garland v. Orleans, P.C. et al. Oral arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Andrew J. McGinnis for the appellant.
Mr. McGinnis, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and Andrew McGinnis for Freddie Garland. In this appeal, we seek review of the district court's dismissal on a 12B6 motion of a Fair Debt Collection Practices action. The district court held that attorneys that do any foreclosure, any whatsoever, are exempt from the federal, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act under the Obdusky decision. Now, the parties have briefed sort of a slew of issues here, but I'm going to try to focus on three in the time I have. And the three I want to talk about are Article III jurisdiction, which was not addressed by the district court, whether the district court properly applied Obdusky. And then the third issue is the district court's failure to address its original jurisdiction under the Class Action Fairness Act. And relatedly, whether or not the defendants have waived a non-jurisdictional argument under the act called the home state exception. I want to start with the operative section of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, which is 15 U.S.C. 1692E, that's E without the parentheses in it, little funny numeration there. That section prohibits the false representation or implication that any individual is an attorney or that any communication is from an attorney.
Mr. McGinnis, can I make a suggestion to you? And I wasn't sure what you meant on one of the three issues that you said you were going to talk about, but I'd suggest that we talk about standing first. If you don't have standing, none of these other issues make any difference.
Exactly, and that was my first subject, Judge. Now, as you well know, under Article III, in order to have standing, you need to have an injury in fact, that's one, two, that's fairly traceable to the conduct of the defendant, and three, that is redressable by the court. The only issue in this case, as I understand defendant's argument, is whether or not there is injury in fact. So the first of those three requirements for Article III standing. In order to plead injury in fact, we need to plead an injury that is, quote, actual or imminent, that is, quote, particularized to the plaintiff, and three, that is concrete. My understanding here is that it's that third of the three elements, concreteness, which is the gist of the argument defendants are making. There's no question that the alleged injury, putting aside the issue whether or not the court deems it concrete enough, was actual or imminent. It was a result of the letter received, and there's no question that it was particularized to this plaintiff. He was the addressee of the letter, and that letter is the foundation of the cause of action.
Why is this case any different than Buchholz? I guess that's the main question I have. We questioned whether bare allegation of anxiety alone was enough, but even assuming it's enough, it wasn't fairly traceable to the letter. It was traceable to the debtor's unwillingness or inability to pay the debt. So we can debate about that, I suppose, but why is the case just not controlled by that case?
Thank you, Your Honor. That was in fact my next point, was that it's distinguishable from the Buchholz opinion, which of course you authored, but your holding, the panel's holding, the court's holding in that case, was that it was not fairly traceable, which is not even an issue that's been presented here. It wasn't fairly traceable because it was the plaintiff's own fear about litigation, which the letter at issue didn't even threaten. So it was it was not fairly traceable. It was one of these, it was not a concreteness inquiry at all. It was a fairly traceable, and defendants haven't even made that argument here, Judge. There's no fair trace.
But why is it different? I don't know what they may or may not be saying that, but this is a jurisdictional question. So I mean, Why is this one traceable where the other one was not?
Because the pleading does not allege that it was a fear of future conduct by the defendant that was the cause of his injury and his anxiety and his intimidation. It was the actual receipt of the letter, which he received and read. So it's not some speculative, you know, in the future, I might do this and it's in my own head, even though they didn't threaten something. The letter at issue in this case says in black and white, the foreclosure process has begun. So it's...
Did he already know that the foreclosure process had begun?
That's not pled in the complaint. And to my knowledge, no. But I don't want to go beyond the record, Judge. That's not pled in the complaint. This is a letter at the time, in my understanding, to be fair to Your Honor's question, that was the initial letter typically sent out for the Wells Fargo client of the Orleans law firm at the initiation of a foreclosure when they get a referral from their client, the mortgage processor.
Does he claim that Wells Fargo had not been telling him in some capacity or respect that if he didn't pay, they were going to foreclose?
So again, not pled in any of the complaint. So I'm reluctant to go beyond the record. But as this court held in Kistner and in the Gilley decision, which was reversed on other grounds, a letter from a law firm, a letter from that appears to be from an attorney, is a horse of a different color. To quote the operative language from the Alvin versus Rubin case in the Seventh Circuit, which this court cited in its Gilley decision, the price of poker has gone up. And so the simple requirement of Section 1692E is that if you're going to send a letter on an attorney letterhead, it's got to be meaningfully reviewed by attorney. That's it. Congress declared it's an abusive and an unfair.
Well, the statute doesn't say that. I mean, the statute doesn't say that it has to be meaning. I mean, it is an attorney on the attorney letterhead. I think the statute was getting at people that were falsely representing that they were attorneys when they called. I mean, I understand we've probably gone beyond that now because of Kristner, but I'm not sure how far beyond that we've gotten. But I guess the gist of the argument is that there's just no way that an attorney could have reviewed this letter, right? Is that your argument?
The pleading, Judge, the complaint is that it was not meaningfully reviewed by an attorney. Yes. And in Kistner, this court cited both Klaman and the Second Circuit and other cases that adopted the meaningful review standard for determining whether or not there's a violation of this specific subsection of the statute.
Let me ask you this before we get away from standing. What, aside from the allegation of anxiety and confusion, is there anything else that is alleged to be a harm to your client here?
Well, we do have an allegation of mental distress, and we do characterize these as intimidation. This is an intimidation claim. And I just want to point out before we leave this topic, you know, Spokeo is the current most cited Supreme Court authority on Article III standing, and specifically on the issue of concreteness, which I believe this case, the jurisdictional allegation is the Article III allegation is based on. That case was decided on May 16th, 2016. The Supreme Court issued another decision that day. It issued a unanimous decision reversing this court's decision in Gilley on other grounds. It was an attorney letterhead case on that day. And the unanimous Supreme Court did not address the jurisdictional issue, did not say we don't have jurisdiction, had a responsibility not to issue a substantive ruling if it determined it didn't have jurisdiction. It's the very day it's issuing Spokeo. And it says, no, that's not misleading. It gets to the merits of the case. I don't think the court needs a more clear indication that Congress has the power to, under the current Supreme Court precedent, and under this court's precedent in Macy and in Donovan, to prescribe this kind of behavior and the risk of material harm that could result from intimidating people to think that a lawyer is sending a letter that a lawyer hasn't meaningfully reviewed.
I didn't see any allegation in Macy, though. It's interesting. There are specific paragraphs in that complaint that talk about what the risk of harm would be in that situation. And I don't see similar paragraphs in your complaint about what the real risk of harm is from these kind of phony attorney letters. I'll call them phony attorney. It's actually an attorney, but I mean, what's the risk of harm? I mean, is you're going to pay something you don't owe? Is that the real thing you're getting at?
The real risk is that you're going to attribute too much weight. You're a homeowner, you're a debtor who's perhaps frequently facing financial challenges. And you're going to say to yourself, boy, an attorney must have figured out that I don't have any defense. I think that the mortgage processor screwed up my payments, didn't apply my escrow correctly. I don't think this is right or fair, but geez, they've got an attorney reviewing this. I'm sunk. I'm not going to, you know, and make decisions in Michigan. If you go forward with a foreclosure by advertisement, you typically get a 6-month redemption period, which means the debtor gets to live there for 6 months without making a payment.
But assuming that everything that you just said makes sense, you didn't make any such allegations at all. You didn't say this letter was harmful because he had defenses or he thought there was a mistake or whatever. You're just simply saying you get a letter that hasn't been reviewed by a lawyer. Therefore, you've been damaged. And going back to Judge Nalbandian's very first question, that just doesn't make sense.
And I think you put your finger on it, Judge. If you hold that there's no adequate standing here based on this complaint, that's tantamount to saying that a debtor that actually owes the money can never have standing under the FDCPA, unless maybe it's a midnight call and harassment. But the whole point of the FDCPA is to protect debtors and to regulate the behavior of debt collectors. In Glaser, a decision authored by Judge Griffin, this court, even though the ultimate holding was partially reversed in Obdusky, the court got it right. That is debt collection. And Justice Breyer's opinion in Obdusky for a unanimous court points that out. And I didn't get a chance to address Obdusky. I understand the panel is focused on Article 3 standing, but I think that the rule that will apply if you say there's no standing here is there's no standing under huge swaths of the FDCPA. And you've got two opinions, published opinions now, including Macy and Donovan, where you've said the risk of material harm. And so that's why I'm making these arguments. And in paragraph 124 on count two, we do allege that there's a risk of material harm. We say in light of this is a state law claim, purpose to avoid misleading communications. By regulated persons, plaintiff and all subclass members suffered an injury under the RCPA because the foreclosure letter suggests that letters were sent by attorney when they were not, rendering the letters misleading and causing actual and potential confusion, anxiety, and mental distress to plaintiff and class members. That's alleging in so many words, and this is a similar allegation for the FDCPA, and I picked the wrong paragraph there, I apologize. But this is material risk of harm. This is the same holding that the Sixth Circuit has held in published opinions in Macy and in Donovan just this past December.
All right. Mr. McGinnis, I do want you to talk about Obdusky briefly. Specifically, Obdusky, to me, holds that businesses such as the defendants here are debt collectors only for purposes of 1692F6. But I see your complaint as alleging a claim under 1692E for allegedly false, deceptive, and misleading representation. So how does your claim come within the liability for defendants under Obdusky?
Your Honor, you're correct. We are not alleging the limited purpose violation. We are alleging a 1692E violation.
Okay, how's that? I mean, I read Odesky as saying that businesses such as this are debt collectors only for F6, and that's a different cause of action, and that's not what you're alleging. So how do you state a claim here?
The way we know that the district court misconstrued Obdusky, and that in fact the holding of Obdusky is far more limited than the reading you suggest, is that the unanimous court goes on to say this doesn't mean that foreclosure attorneys have carte blanche to do whatever they want to do. If they do midnight phone calls, they'll still be subject to the statute. The only way you get there, Judge Griffin, is if you read the opinion as we've laid out in the brief, and as the court was careful to combine that ruling several times to say, when you're doing the things required by state foreclosure law, you are protected under that reading. But wait, once you go outside of it, you are not.
Can I ask you a question? Sure. Is there, if let's assume I'm not doing something required by state law.
Yes.
Okay. Do you think that there's then everything else is fair game, or are there three categories? There's something that is required by state law. There's something that is abusive, repetitive nighttime calls. And there's something else that is merely perhaps a violation of the statute, but is not abusive, whatever that means. Or are you saying that anything that's not required by state law falls into the abusive category?
I'm not saying that, Judge. I'm saying that anything that is not required by state law in the context of a foreclosure is debt collection and subject to the other restraints of the statute. It doesn't mean it's abusive. There's many, many foreclosure attorneys who for many years.
But we know from Obdusky that the liability for this quote unquote debt collector has to be tied to abusive behavior, right? I mean, Justice Breyer's opinion said, we're not giving you carte blanche. You can't do something abusive. I don't know what that means. The only example he gives is repetitive nighttime calls, but it can't be that he means everything in the statute that's a violation would be problematic, right?
I respectfully disagree. I don't even understand how that argument follows. In other words, there's no, Congress has already defined under its legislative power under Article 1, what it considers to be fair and unfair debt collection. And so this notion that you're going to distinguish between abusive and not abusive on these myriad other violations is just putting the court in a horrible position.
But what's the point
of that? I'm sorry,
what's the point of that part of the opinion then? I don't understand that. I'm trying to make heads and tails here of Obdusky, but I'm trying to figure out what's going on in that last page or last few pages of that opinion where he says, look, you're going to be exempt from the lion's share of stuff here, but you're not going to get away with everything, like repetitive nighttime calls. And that to me is he's slicing, the Justice Breyer is slicing it up so that we're left with a few categories. Is that's not right?
It can't be. The only clear line is to say, is what we argue in the brief. If you're following state foreclosure law, the court in Obdusky, the unanimous court, was trying to reconcile the major definition with the special, the subpart definition, the secondary. And it did it repeatedly by saying, we understand that the challenged conduct in this case was required by state foreclosure law, Colorado foreclosure law. That's it. The court never said, you've got broad license to do anything unless we think it's abusive or, I mean, that in Donovan, this court in this past December said, we want a bright line test. We don't like these fuzzy areas. And so that's why we filed our citation of supplemental authority based on this court's recent published Donovan decision to say, this is the clear path. And it doesn't mean that once they step beyond what's required by state foreclosure law, they're automatically deemed to be abusive. We don't allege that. There were many different ways they could have not been a violation. They could have had attorneys actually review in a meaningful sense these letters. They could have put a disclaimer in the letter saying this, just because you got this letter doesn't mean we've done a considered review of your file. So it's certainly not, it's not a, a sort of falling off the cliff. And I hope, Judge Griffin, that answers your question.
Okay, it does. All right, you're way out of time. Any further questions, Judge McKeague?
No, thank you.
Judge Novena, you'll have your 4 minutes rebuttal, Mr. McGinnis. Let's hear from the counsel for Appalee.
May it please the court. My name is I.W. Winston, and I represent the defendants, Appalese. There are multiple alternative grounds to affirm the dismissal of each of Garland's two claims, his federal FDCPA claim and his Michigan law RCPA claim. As you decide this appeal, it is important to put in context what's really going on here. This is an attorney letterhead case where Garland's claim is that he was confused over whether a letter he received in connection with his non-judicial foreclosure that was on the Orleans law firm's letterhead was from an attorney who actually reviewed his matter. Garland does not contend that the actual contents of the letter were inaccurate or misleading in any way. He just says he was confused over whether an attorney had reviewed it. That's his sole complaint. He doesn't allege he was subject to any other allegedly improper conduct, such as late night harassing phone calls or anything. And he seeks as his sole remedy the statutory fines available under these acts. He does not seek or even claim that he has suffered any damages. In fact, the only harm that Garland mentions in his complaint is the conclusory allegation that his confusion caused him anxiety because the possibility that the letter was from an attorney suggested to him that his prospects for avoiding foreclosure were diminished. That's it. He doesn't claim he took any action as a result of being confused or anxious, or that he relied to his detriment on the letter either being from or not from an attorney. And he does not dispute that he owed the debt secured by the mortgage or that he failed to pay it. And he does not dispute that his lender had the right to foreclose in a non-judicial foreclosure and that it did so properly. He also brought this case as a punitive class action under both acts.
You think that, so I take it you don't think that the differences between this letter and the letter in Buchholz are material? I mean, they're in this letter, it says that foreclosure proceedings have begun, which seems to be saying a little bit more than the letter did in Buchholz, right?
Well, but I think Buchholz is dead on point for two reasons. Number one, it says in this circumstance, you flunk the traceability requirement of standing because your injury is self-inflicted because you didn't pay your debts. And then secondly, the court was very skeptical whether being anxious alone was sufficient to satisfy the injury in fact requirement. So I think that the holding of Buchholz is dead on. And of course, Judge Griffin, you were on that panel. In terms though of the kind of the background of what's going on here, it's important. Hey, I think.
Let me ask you this question about Buchholz. One thing that Buchholz did not do, because for various reasons, was analyze whether there was a real risk of harm or material risk of harm involved. If we were to look at that question in this case, why wouldn't we say that the statute, there is a real risk of harm when you have somebody posing as an attorney or something on attorney letterhead is going to make a debtor more likely to do something that they wouldn't ordinarily do?
Okay, so first of all, Garland did not plead that there was an impending risk of harm at all. He did not plead that. And he took no detrimental action because of his alleged anxiety or in reliance on his confusion. And I submit, Your Honors, that the requirement for a concrete injury would be eviscerated if a plaintiff could simply make a conclusory allegation of anxiety and thereby satisfy the injury in fact requirement with respect to a bare procedural violation of the act. And that's all we have here. And I would also say,
The response to that is the Judge Murphy obviously concurred in Buchholz and said, look, there are plenty of times where we do some, where something that looks like anxiety or mental damage, mental distress is recognized as an injury for at least for Article III purposes. Why does that not apply as opposed to what the majority in Buchholz said?
Well, first of all, under Iqbal, this court can disregard Garland's allegation of anxiety because it's conclusory and he alleged no specific facts to support it. He alleged nothing as to duration or severity or how it was manifested or whether he ever received treatment. For all we know, Garland's purported anxiety lasted only for a nanosecond, if that long. And so I would suggest that the court adopt the Seventh Circuit's approach in Brunette, that an FDCPA plaintiff's confusion or anxiety does not satisfy standing requirements.
Let me ask this question about that opinion, because it certainly says state of confusion, but it really doesn't say anxiety, does it?
No, it focuses on confusion as opposed to anxiety. But I think for these purposes, they're synonymous terms.
Okay.
Especially when, I mean, all we have is the conclusion, I was anxious. We don't have anything more. There's no indication in the complaint that the plaintiff in any material way suffered anxiety. And if you let a plaintiff in an FDCPA case satisfy standing by saying I was anxious, you've just written out the injury in fact requirement. You've written out of the standing. Everybody can get past it with a conclusory allegation of anxiety, which is, I don't think, what anybody's intent here was. If I may, it's important to focus on this case is dominated by the state law claim because that seeks many, many times the amount sought here in the federal claim. But it's undisputed that the state law claim could not be brought as a class action in state court because a Michigan court rule bars the assertion of a class action where, like here, the class seeks only statutory fines. This is undisputed here. So what's going on here is that Garland seeks to bring a class action under the state statute, which dwarfs the federal claim in federal court, when he could not do this in state court. And he seeks up to $200 in fines on behalf of thousands of people who are allegedly part of his putative class for a state claim, when he would be barred from doing this in state court. And he contends that there should be CAFA jurisdiction over his state law claim when his complaint does not identify a single member of the putative class who is a citizen of another state. But he contends that he can satisfy the requirement for minimal diversity under CAFA by just speculating in his complaint that an unidentified member of the class, and the class consists of all Michigan borrowers who were foreclosed, that an unidentified member of the class must now have moved out of Michigan and become a citizen of another state.
Do you think the standing analysis takes care of the federal and the state claims, right? I assume, or not?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, standing is dispositive here on everything.
Okay, so we only get to this CAFA issue if we think there's a viable possible state claim, right?
Correct.
Okay. Why is it implausible to say that in the last 10 years, not one of these people has moved out of state? I mean, is it just, it's, we can all agree that's plausible, but it's just up to the plaintiff to allege it or find somebody to satisfy minimal diversity?
Yes. I mean, I think the way this works is, the way federal subject matter jurisdiction works, federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction. There's a presumption against federal jurisdiction. And a plaintiff must allege actual facts to invoke federal jurisdiction. You can't satisfy minimal diversity through speculative speculation and conclusory allegations. And that's all we have here. And the failure to identify a member of the class that was diverse is inexcusable here because Garland concedes he has a list of all the names and addresses of every Michigan borrower upon whom Orleans foreclosed. He had the ability to determine if there was a diverse member of the class, but instead all we got was speculation. CAFA does not impose much, but it imposes two things. You got to have minimal jurisdiction. You got to identify a specific out-of-state person and you've got to allege and demonstrate $5 million at issue. And he also flunks the $5 million at issue requirement. The way he gets to $5 million is by speculating that every Michigan borrower who was foreclosed got a letter like the one that Garland received.
Is your client a corporation? Is it an LLC? What is the actual?
It's a PC.
Okay. And so it's governed by corporate, like either principal place of business or at home, not like a, it doesn't have members that would be in other states.
Right. It isn't like an LLC or a partnership.
Right. Okay.
Mr. Winston, if we were to get past the jurisdictional issue as to the state law claim, tell me how the state law claim does not state a claim upon which relief can be granted. The federal claim, to me, has problems with Ordusky and whether Ordusky does not allow this under the federal law. But how about the state law? Why does that not state a claim?
Sure. Good question, Your Honor. There's a host of reasons why, once the FDCPA claim is gone, that the state claim goes too. First, you got the standing issue. Same sure. standing issue applies
to the state. I said, let's get past jurisdiction.
Yeah, okay.
If we get past it, tell me why it doesn't state a claim.
Secondly, the plaintiff's entire position here is that the state act should be construed consistent with the federal act. Therefore,
But it's different. It's different though, isn't it?
It is. And I'm getting to that. But his overall claim is interpreted the same way. So if you know, just from a superficial standpoint.
Okay. Even if he argues that the laws are the same, I mean, we have an obligation to correctly apply the law, even if the attorneys get it wrong. And if the attorneys get it wrong, we still have to get the law right. So, all right, let's get to the law.
Okay. The state act excludes a collection agency from the definition of a regulated person. Orleans is not a regulated person under the state act. A collection agency is defined to include a person engaged in repossessing or attempting to repossess a thing of value. The definition of a regulated person does not include an attorney repossessing or attempting to repossess a thing of value. And likewise, the act only prescribes misleading communications in connection with the collection of debt and does not prescribe such communications in connection with the repossession of property. Therefore, the state act, which was created shortly after FDCPA and was intended in effect to mimic it, has the same kind of exclusion for security interest enforcers. It's not meant to capture security interest enforcers under the definition of regulated persons. That's number one. Number two.
But what do we do? Okay, well, what do we do with the fact that the Supreme Court says in Ordusky that we're not giving you complete immunity? There are some things you can't do. The one thing we know you can't do is repetitive nighttime calls. What is the line? What is it that you aren't able to do as a security interest enforcer that's acting as a quote-unquote debt collector?
If I may, I want to answer it two ways. The first way is you never need to get to that issue, and let me explain why, and then I'll get to the substance of it. In Bates, in 2020, this court broadly applied Ordusky and held that parties who assist creditors with the non-judicial foreclosure of a home do not fall within the general definition of a debt collector. Importantly, Bates held that a complaint, and I'm quoting, does not adequately plead that a lawyer is a debt collector under the Act's general definition if it alleges only that a lawyer helped a lender undertake a non-judicial foreclosure, close quote. That's all Garland pled here.
But Bates, if my recollection is that Bates involved someone who was complying or doing something pursuant to state law, right? This was an antecedent step under state law in Bates, and I'm assuming you're not in that box. And just so we're in this world outside of Ordusky, outside of Bates, where you're doing something, and I don't know exactly whether I'm just trying to figure out what is it that you're exempt from if you're not acting pursuant to state law.
Okay, so Ordusky says that, in the language you were quoting from Breyer, but if you engage in other abusive activities where you're not deciding whether or not that brings you back within the ambit of the act. Here, there's no allegation that we've engaged in any other allegedly improper activity. So there's nothing additional here to bring us back within the orbit. But I want to go back to the Bates point for reason.
The phony attorney letter is possibly would be, I would say, is that the same as a repetitive nighttime call?
Well, that letter is not covered. The act does not apply to us because Congress excluded security interest enforcers from 1692E under their definitions.
Right. But the opinion in Obdusky is, yeah, except we do include you. I mean,
yes,
you do include you if you're being abusive. That's the way I read it. It's an odd way to do definitions in a statute. I don't disagree with that. I'm just saying that's I'm trying to apply it. And it says, hey, if you're being abusive, then I'm going to call you a debt collector.
Well, they don't say that. What they say is we're not deciding that. And my suggestion, my guess is that language got included in order to keep the decision unanimous. But they're not deciding that brings you back within the ambit. They're just saying we don't have to deal with that now.
It's pretty clear that the opinion is pretty clear, don't you think? Hey, we're not giving you blanket immunity. So you do not have blanket immunity. We agree, right? So number two, I'm giving you a suggestion of what might fall into the liability. That would be repetitive nighttime calls. So why is repetitive nighttime calls different than sending the phony attorney letter? And I understand it's not phony, whatever, but I'm just calling it that.
Yeah. I think those are good questions, Your Honor. And I think they're going to be sorting out whether there are three buckets or two buckets, as you asked my opposing counsel. But again, I think it's important here to focus on the fact that Bates said, we don't have to deal with any of this stuff because unless the plaintiff proves that you have a principal purpose other than non-judicial foreclosures in the complaint, you're not within the general definition. And in this case, he pled the exact opposite. He pled that the vast majority of our foreclosures are non-judicial foreclosures, that his home was foreclosed through a non-judicial foreclosure. So he doesn't plead what Bates requires to have a chance to come in within the ambit of the general definition.
I apologize because Judge Griffin's question was about the Michigan statute, but you referred back to the federal. So I guess I go back to the state issue then. How does all that work with the way the Michigan statute works? You're saying that if you don't, under that Bates test, if you're basically just a security interest enforcer, you're also not a debt collector under the Michigan statute?
Yes, under the definition of regulated person, and we set this out in our brief, if you work through that, you'll come to the conclusion that a security interest enforcer, just like in the FDCPA, is not covered, and that makes sense since the state statute mimics the federal. But there's more. The state statute has an additional injury requirement. The state act specifically requires in section 7 that Garland plead that he suffered an injury, loss, or damage to recover, and he has to plead that and prove it even if he seeks only statutory fines. You have to show an actual injury to recover, and here there's none, for all the reasons we've been discussing. So in addition to constitutional standing, there's a more strict statutory standing requirement requiring that you show injury, loss, or damage. And he's disclaimed all that. He doesn't claim any damages. He's only seeking the fines.
You're saying that even if anxiety were enough for Article 3, there would have to be even more under the Michigan statute, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Under Section 7. Mr. Winston, you're out of time. Any further questions, Judge McKeague?
No, thank you.
Judge Nalbandian? All right, Mr. Winston, we spent a lot of your time with questions, but I'll give you 1 minute to wrap it up if you want.
Thank you, Your Honors, and thank you for your work on our case. You've obviously read it very carefully, and we all appreciate it. Garland lacks constitutional standing to assert any of his claims here. And if you were to buy into bear anxiety satisfies, then you've eviscerated the standing requirements because the injury in fact and requirement becomes non-existent. On traceability, Buchholz is dead on point. The injury here is self-inflicted. And under Obdusky and Bates, the statutes at issue here do not even apply to Oregonland's actions because they were in connection with the enforcement of a security interest. and there's no CAFA jurisdiction, even if the and there's no CAFA jurisdiction over the state claim because Carlin failed to plead minimal diversity, not a single identified member of the putative class. And again, on the state claim, the putative class consists only of Michigan borrowers who were foreclosed. So in order to be able to make his claim, he's got to be able to show that one of those people has moved out of state and is a citizen of a different state. He never alleges it. He just speculates. That's not sufficient to invoke federal jurisdiction. And we ask that you affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Winston. Mr. McGinnis, you have 4 minutes rebuttal.
You're on mute. You're muted.
Somehow I knew I was going to do that. Thank you, Donna. Confusion is not the same as anxiety. In the Kistner case, this court held that confusion establishes a violation of the attorney letterhead prescription, because a letter that can be interpreted as both either from attorney or not from an attorney is a violation. And so that anxiety stands as a distinct violation. We cite in our reply brief in this court the Michigan Court of Appeals Zwerk case, Z-W-E-R-K, in which mental distress, anxiety is a compensable damage under Michigan fraud law for damages. That's been the case for many years. And so I understand the impulse of the defendants and the appellee to try to push the analogy to an intentional infliction of emotional distress claim. That's not what the relevant comparison is. Under Lujan, under Spokeo, Congress has the authority to elevate intangible injuries to Article III standing. And one of the tests is whether it's comparable to a common law claim. We have a common law 1692E, false, deceptive, or misleading representations. It's clearly analogous to a fraud claim. And we have Michigan law telling us that emotional distress, mental distress are compensable damages for a fraud claim under Michigan law. So that establishes that. There's an argument in Mr. Winston's argument that we violated Iqbal, or we don't withhold. I refer the court to where have I put my Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 9, which states that for 9B, fraud or mistake, conditions of the mind in alleging fraud or mistake, a party must state with particularity the circumstances constituting fraud or mistake. We've done that. Malice, intent, knowledge, and any other condition of a person's mind may be alleged generally. So that's an invitation for you to violate or to disregard the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure to say we have to go into great detail when the rule specifically allows us to allege anxiety generally. He asked you to follow Brunette. Brunette and other Seventh Circuit cases that we've supplied in our response to a citation of supplemental authority expressly recognize the Seventh Circuit doesn't follow Macy. It doesn't follow this circuit's precedent, published precedent, on this issue of standing. The Seventh Circuit interprets Spokeo differently than the circuit under two published decisions. There was an argument here about the motive in trying to get to bootstrap a state class action onto the federal. He didn't mention the case. It's Shady Grove. That was an opinion decided by Justice Scalia. And this is something that's come up in other cases in the district. He's arguing, so we're just doing what Shady Grove and Justice Scalia told us was proper. He argues that Orleans is not a regulated person. Every judge in the Eastern and the Western District, this argument has been made multiple times, has held that a foreclosure law firm is a regulated person under the Michigan Regulation of Collection Practices Act, including Judge Rosen, and even the Western District initially had one decision going the other way, and it has since followed the Eastern District on this. I would just point out, my last point is that Judge Nalbandian, you invited Mr. Winston to give you a line of demarcation on those three categories. With respect, he didn't answer it. To the extent he answered it, he asked for the complete carte blanche that we know the unanimous court in Obdusky said is not foreclosure law firms are not entitled to. And the only other way that Obdusky doesn't apply is if you're going to drag the court into deciding which quote unquote abusive conduct is somehow outside of Obdusky or in. We've offered the only clear line of demarcation. You follow the state foreclosure law. It's published. This is what you're hired to do, after all. This is your profession, and you've got the protection of Obdusky. It's not a hard, it's not an unfair or harsh reading of Obdusky. If you step outside, if you don't follow, if you're doing something completely not required by that statute, by the state foreclosure law, then you fall within the general definition of a debt collector. I thank you for your time and attention. Right.
Thank you, Mr. McGinnis. Any further questions, Judge McKeague?
No, thank you.
Abandian. All right. Thank you for your arguments. Case will be submitted. You may adjourn the court.
Thank you. This honorable court is now adjourned.